Good evening and welcome to Behind the News for November 14, 2002. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. And we've got two interviews up for tonight. First, we'll talk with Rita Shera, the public opinion expert, who is a fellow of the Century Foundation based in Washington, D.C., or I guess you could call him, as the Brits do, a sophologist. But I don't think that term is very widely used in the United States. And then at the bottom of the hour, we'll listen to an interview I recorded just a couple of hours ago with Bonnie Brower, who is the executive director of the City Project, about the city budget situation, which is dire, and some information that is coming out of the Bloomberg administration on how they plan to close a gigantic budget gap. The economic news is kind of mixed. The Federal Reserve meeting earlier this week decided to cut short-term interest rates by half a percent, cut interest rates by half a percentage point. They say it's just insurance to prod the economic recovery along. Earlier in the week, the president of the Minneapolis Federal Reserve, Gary Stern, said that we definitely have an economic recovery underway, but it's not spectacular. And his phrase for characterizing the U.S. economy was not terrible, which is really quite something to cheer about, isn't it? It's not terrible. And then I came in here to find in my mailbox a fax from the Committee of on Ways and Means of the House of Representatives. The Republican staff is constantly sending out these missives, most of which go straight into the trash. But this one is kind of amusing. They're celebrating their election victory, and they say, these past 2 years, Republicans in Congress worked hard to deliver tax relief, create jobs, and promote economic growth. Well, we're about 2 million jobs off from where we were when they 2 years ago, so if they've been working hard to create jobs, they're not doing a very good job of it. Promote economic growth, well, as the president of the Minneapolis Fed said, the economy is not terrible, but that's hardly something to get very excited about. So, but the Republicans promised more of the same, which is kind of a frightening prospect. The election of last week was a rather depressing affair, not, of course, that Democrats are such wonderful folks, but this is truly a gang of ghouls and freaks that are running things now. And I think strike fear into many hearts, rightly so. Rita Shera, along with John Judas, are the authors of a book that was recently published called The Emerging Democratic Majority. David Brooks, the conservative commentator, had some fun with that concept in the Sunday Times Week in Review. He said it's going to take a lot more time to emerge. I tried to get David Brooks on to speak with Rita Shera about it, but he wasn't available today, so I'm going to impersonate David Brooks and ask Rui what's going on. Welcome to WBI, Rita Shera.
Hi, Doug.
Welcome. So tell us, where is that emerging Democratic majority? We certainly didn't see it emerging last week.
No, it didn't, but then again, the book was really about trends that we feel will manifest themselves during this decade. And we were always very careful to say that in the book. And in fact, we wrote it, finished writing it as after 9/11, so, you know, we were definitely aware of the fact that this was going to have some effect on American politics, at least for a few years, if not longer. But and we said we wouldn't, in essence, we said we won't be surprised if the Democrats don't do so well in this coming election in 2002, given the salience of national security concerns. But, you know, we expect that over the long haul, the same trends will manifest themselves. Actually, we like John and I think a lot of other people, got a little bit more optimistic than we should have been based on the polling data that was coming in right before the election, or at least up until about a week before the election. It looked like the Democrats weren't going to do great, but they were going to pick up maybe a seat or two in the Senate. They might not take back the House, but they might not lose seats either. They would do very well in the governorships. And all those things didn't turn out as well as people expected. And that was disappointing, but I think not unexpected, or let's put it this way, not inexplicable, given the sort of the influence of national security concerns and the pretty terrible campaign the Democrats ran.
Well, I want to get back to all these issues in a moment,
sure.
But before we get there, there's been some talk in the public opinion world that polls now are just not as reliable as they used to be. People are not answering their phones, less compliance, more people using cell phones, and therefore not available by traditional techniques. So is the whole industry in need of a rethink, or is it you still think that the poll numbers are kind of reliable?
Well, they're still probably better than guessing what's going on, but they do seem to be developing more problems because of this non-response bias and this ability, sort of lack of ability to get the sampling frame nailed down because it's hard to get a hold of some people. That said, I mean, some people do appear to get it right. Maybe what it means is that you've got to be an even better pollster than you were in the past, do more careful sampling, and be more careful about how you draw your not only draw your sample, but how you select within it. I mean, Gallup did a pretty good job, for example. They caught the pro-Republican surge among pro-Republican surge among likely voters very clearly and well in the last week before the election. They pretty much called the election right. The state races they did, they were mostly right, and they did a good job. But these other polls, it may be the case that as things get a little dicier, the cheaper and more shoddily done polls just get farther and farther off, or at least have the potential to be so. And the ones that are done very well are going to be the ones that are, sort of you can trust most in and get closer to the actual result. But sort of like the standard deviation will go up, as it were. So what do you do about that? Geez, I don't know.
I certainly can't rely on internet polls.
Yeah, the internet poll is like the other thing that people bring up as like a solution. I don't see how that's a solution. But I know there's this one firm out in California that tries to do something like this where they draw a sample and then they give them computers is what they do, see? You know, you don't sample the people already on the internet. You sample the population and then you give them the computer and, conduct the poll that way. Now, that's okay for a really heavy-duty, expensive national poll. Well, it's not going to work very well for these endless telephone surveys, political surveys they want to do right prior to an election.
And speaking of election surveys, we are also deprived of our usual diet of exit polls. What happened, and what are we doing without them?
Well, what happened is that they apparently conducted the interviews, but when they started to analyze them using their computer models, they started coming out with kind of crazy results, and they decided that their attempt to fix the system after the 2000 problems had just been a complete disaster, and they just refused to release the data. So, for example, in Colorado, they were apparently getting results that had Tom Strickland 20 points ahead of Wayne Allard, which was just ridiculous. They knew that Strickland had some chance of winning that election, but he was going to win by 20 points, so it was just too far off. They had similar problems in other states, and they just gave up. I mean, it's really just about as big a disaster as you could possibly have in that kind of a situation, because, it's not like you canceled a month before. It's like they canceled the day it was happening. And, will we ever get exit poll data? I've asked people who should know, or certainly would be more likely to know than me, and nobody's got a clue whether they're ever going to release it or not.
So they have raw data. And
they have the raw data.
But they just don't know how to assemble it into something meaningful.
Exactly.
Now, of course, talking about they got Florida right, really. I mean, if you're of the school that the Bush family conspired to steal the Florida election, their call wasn't so far off.
That's
in the first
right.
Place.
Right, yeah. Kind of food for thought there, huh? maybe it wasn't as broken as they thought,
so,
and they shouldn't have fixed it.
Let's get back to this election. One of the problems, it seems, was, although we, again, don't have the exit poll numbers to prove this, but it seems that turnout among the Democratic base, particularly black voters, was rather low. Is that your impression, and did that have much of an effect on the final outcome?
Well, I was just looking at some of those data this afternoon. Exit polls are kind of a blunt and imperfect instrument anyway for assessing turnout trends, but they were better than nothing, and we don't have them. So what people are now doing is they're relying on pre-election polls or polls that were taken on election night or election day done over the telephone and trying to assess turnout from looking at the sample of these small polls and comparing it to what happened 2 years ago. If you look at these data, they do suggest not that blacks and Hispanics, particularly blacks, voted in any less, with any less force for Democrats. I mean, it looks like another overwhelming pro-democratic sort of day for Democrats among blacks, kind of like 9-1. But it does seem to be the case that blacks turned out at levels that were lower than 2000. And the same thing was true for Hispanics in most states except for Texas, when it looks where it looks like they might have gone up. Now, how important was that? That's another issue. I mean, in California, low black turnout didn't matter much because the Democrats did so well, or low turnout among Hispanics. In Florida, the Democrats did so poorly, there's no way that additional black voters in any reasonable numbers could have made a difference. I mean, Jeb Bush would have been elected anyway. But if you look at close races like the Carnahan race in Missouri and a few others, it's certainly possible that black turnout was an important factor, low black turnout.
Well, in California, Gray Davis won, but not by anywhere near the kind of...
Yeah, no, he would have won by more. But, I mean, in terms of who's winds up in the statehouse,
it doesn't
matter. But it's certainly something for the Democrats to think about for the longer haul.
Now, let's get back to your thesis about the emerging Democratic majority. Your title, of course, is a play on Kevin Phillips' famous title about the emerging Republican majority of 30 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Kevin Phillips was, of course, talking about playing on white rage and, the wedge issues and building a base in the South and pretty much forecast the political history of the last 20 or 30 years. What's your counter to the Phillips strategy?
Well, our counter to the Phillips strategy was, as we outlined in the book, we feel like these emerging constituencies like minorities, women, and professionals and voters who, in particular, who are in these fast-growing, economically dynamic areas of the country we call ideopolises, are a great base on which to build a Democratic majority. And you add to that the fact that, and not unrelated, actually, to these trends, is that the majority of the population is sort of moving in the direction of a support for a sort of moderate government activism and understanding or seeing more the need for the government to regulate the excesses of the market, and the sort of the cultural liberalism of the 60s, which once put people off, is now in a moderate form, accepted by most people in America. And we think that, those trends look like they'll continue, and that provides an opportunity for the Democrats to build a majority coalition. And I guess one thing we take away from the 2002 results is that it's just that. It's an opportunity. It doesn't automatically mean anything's going to happen. Given unusual events and given a lack of creativity and enthusiasm on the part of Democrats, it can definitely turn out in a different way. We still think the trends are fundamentally on the side of the Democrats in this decade.
What kind of geographical areas are you talking about, these ideopolises?
Well, you could think of areas like the Research Triangle in North Carolina, really the New York metro area, the Boston metro area, the Minneapolis area in Minnesota, Portland area, and the Seattle area in Washington, the Bay Area in L.A. and California, the Tucson area in Arizona, Austin area in Texas, the high-tech and tourist areas of Florida. I mean, it's really all over the country, not just in the Northeast or on the West Coast, but also in various parts of the Midwest and even the South. So it's really where the country is sort of moving ahead the most economically, and where you have the production of ideas and services sort of tending to weight, sort of become more important than the production of things, or even to the extent manufacturing is still important, it's manufacturing that has been reconfigured and reshaped by these economic changes. So those are the areas where we find the Democrats are doing rather well and have... that's where the trends have really favored them over the last 20 years.
What kind of ideological agenda are we talking about here?
Well, the ideological agenda is what we call in our book a kind of progressive centrism, based on the idea that, as I was saying earlier, the government has an important role to play in dealing with the market and providing social services and support, and also a kind of a shared culture that has to do with respect for the rights of women and minorities, diversity, tolerance, protecting the environment, all of the things that came out of the 60s that in their extreme form helped provoke the Republican backlash that Kevin Phillips talked about, but in their moderate form, I think, have really kind of taken over the country.
This sounds like Clintonism without adultery.
We're trying to lose the adultery stuff. We feel that didn't help promote the emerging Democratic majority. Or at any rate, if people are going to do adultery, they don't want you know, the highest elected officials in the land participating in a flagrant way. But that's a tactical question.
But it is sort of a Clinton-esque DLC kind of politics you're talking about.
Well, it's certainly got some influence of the DLC in it, and we do feel the DLC played an important role in helping move the Democrats to the center, changing their image on a number of important issues where it was getting in the way of reaching voters. But on the other hand, we feel the DLC traditionally has been tied too closely to business interests, is too unwilling to criticize business priorities, is almost dogmatic about its attitude towards so-called populism, where sort of anything that smacks of really strong government activism or anything that smacks of opposing vigorously corporate priorities is to be avoided because somehow American voters don't like that sort of thing. We don't buy that. We don't think that's correct, and we don't think that's what the voters were talking about and necessarily looking for.
I'm speaking with Reed Teixeira, who is the co-author, along with John Judas, of a book called The Emerging Democratic Majority and also a fellow at the Century Foundation based in Washington. Brooks, in his piece, David Brooks, in his piece in the Sunday Times, had some fun with your title and your thesis. But the core of his argument is that the kinds of areas you're talking about, these ideopolises, are actually overshadowed and provided the by what he calls these exurban regions, whose political priorities are more highways and less growth, which mm-hmm. is a rather frightening agenda. But he says this is the kind of mix that gave us the Republican victories last week. What's your response to his argument?
Well, I think definitely the it's not, you can't argue with the idea the exurban areas tend to be Republican, because they do. You look at these outer suburbs, even in these sort of ideopolis type metropolitan areas, and they're typically much more Republican than the rest of the region. On the other hand, they typically also are much smaller than the big suburban counties that ring the cities and where most of the people are and most of that growth and actual people actually is. For example, look at the D.C. area, look at the Northern Virginia suburbs. Loudoun County is one of the fastest growing counties in the country, and probably I think the sixth fastest growing county in the country. But despite that, and the fact that Loudoun is Republican, the Northern Virginia metro area has been shifting steadily toward the Democrats. George Bush's father carried the Northern Virginia suburbs by 20 points, and then in 2000, the Al Gore race, it was about a push. So this is just, I mean, there are other examples that I could mention, but the basic concept is that, yes, these Republican areas at the edges of metropolitan areas tend to grow fast, and they tend to be Republican, but they tend not to be big enough to affect the overall political trends in the metropolitan area. And another thing that's important to observe about them, which really gets directly to Brooks's thesis in the article you're talking about, is that as they get bigger, they tend to get denser, they tend to get more diverse, they tend to develop a different set of problems, and they tend to become more democratic. All of those things are true. They don't stay 2-to-1 Republican or more for forever. As they get bigger, they tend to move democratic, so that even if they're Republican, they remain Republican in terms of a majority. It's a much smaller majority than before.
But as he characterizes these regions, once people move there, they want to make sure that no one else does. So they really want to limit growth, but they want to
but I don't think they can. You know, what are they going to do? Stand at the county line with guns? I mean, people will move where there's economic opportunity. They'll move where they want to move. And I think it's going to be difficult for, no matter what these troglodytes who move to Douglas County in Colorado or Loudoun County in Virginia or Gwinnett County in Georgia, whatever they want, in terms of slowing down growth, it's going to be hard for them to do so. And as they get bigger, they develop a different set of problems, and they come to sympathize a little bit more with the democratic approach to things.
Well, I mean, we're accustomed to thinking of suburbs as fairly affluent regions, but some of the older suburbs around our older cities have a lot of like quasi-urban problems now.
Sure. Well, if you look at a lot of closer-in suburbs or closer-in suburban areas and big, big metropolitan areas, they'll tend to have a real mix of, you know, populations and of economic strata. They'll have, you know, they tend to be very diverse in terms of the race-ethnic mix. They tend to have very affluent areas, and they tend to have very poor areas. And the affluent areas tend to be populated in many, many areas by professionals, by people who, by dint of various attitudes toward toward government and toward cultural issues are relatively liberal and disposed to vote Democratic. So you have a combination of relatively liberal whites, you know, minorities, a mix of different strata. And then when you get into the outer suburbs, that's more where you get managers, you get people with sort of middle-level sort of white-collar jobs who tend not to have the same ethos as the professionals in the inner suburbs. So, but again, that too changes over time as these areas grow and develop. So, but yeah, the inner suburbs are now in many areas have become developed a pretty pronounced Democratic tilt. In fact, one of the big stories about this election that is not alluded to by Brooks, but it's very important, and you can't understand what happened without it, is the fact that in a lot of these Democratic leaning suburbs, you know, inner suburbs, the Democrats did not do as well in 2002 as they did in previous elections. In other words, what the Republicans were able to do is reduce the Democratic margins in areas that are right around these big cities and these inner suburbs. And that really hurt the Democrats a lot because that's where they an area they rely upon now for votes. For example,
how were they able to do that?
How are the Democrats?
How are the Republicans able to narrow?
Oh, well, I think that, you know, that gets us back to why did they do so well in this election in general in terms of the programmatically. And I think it was a mix of national security issues, people wanting to support the president, you know, putting out the Iraq thing in late August and keeping it alive for 6 weeks. I mean, it had a huge effect in the dialogue in this election. I think the other side of it is that Democrats are not able to speak to the economic unease and worries of people in these areas with their program because they really didn't have one. You know, it was Social Security and prescription drugs plus, you know, pointing out to people something they already knew, which is the economy isn't very good. So, you know, at the margin, that means that the people who sort of have some likelihood of voting Republican if they're not pushed in the right direction, were pushed in the other direction. They were pushed toward voting Republican, and they did. And you don't need to change that many minds at the margin to reduce Democratic vote totals in those counties. For example, if you look at the Carnahan race in Missouri, and you look at St. Louis County, you know, high-tech St. Louis County right outside of St. Louis City, the Democrats, if the Democrats had done as well with Gene Carnahan in 2002 as they'd done with Mel Carnahan, God rest his soul, in 2000, they would almost have won the race right there. I mean, Carnahan lost by 23,000 votes, and they probably lost 16,000 votes in St. Louis County just from having a smaller margin in that county. So these things are very, very important. The Democrats have to keep up, you know, keep reaching those suburban voters in the areas where they're strong, or else the Republicans will be able to overwhelm them with high turnout in exurbs and rural areas. And, you know, obviously in this election, again, the relatively low turnout, as far as we can figure out, among minorities and big city voters didn't help either.
What do you make of the Democrats picking, or House Democrats, they're picking San Francisco liberal Nancy Pelosi as their leader?
Well, you know, I mean, in the short term, it's probably a disaster in the sense that, you know, it's just terrific PR for the Republicans. They'll make all kinds of hay out of this. The direct mail letters are already being churned out there. In the medium to long term, it might actually be good because what the Democrats do need, I think, is some vigorous leadership and a willingness to take on the president and the administration at their weak and vulnerable points and to really push it. I think one thing we learned from 2002 is voters aren't very interested in a party that is too wimpy and has really nothing to say. They'd rather vote for a party that does have something to say. And the Democrats have to heed that, and Pelosi can help move them in that direction. She's, by all accounts, a very tough and smart politician, and if she picks her fights right, and I think she's just the kind of person who might really be able to lead the Democrats to some victories and some good politics. We'll just have to see. I think it all depends on that. I think that if she comes out of the box and she's not effective and, you know, she's easily tarred as a liberal without being very effective politically, it'll be pretty bad, but we'll see.
And if the Democrats were to follow your recommendations and appeal to the sort of Ideopolis agenda or population, and does that mean sort of throwing their base over the edge into the water or not?
Oh, not at all. I mean, my view on this for a long time, and the 2002 elections just make me more convinced, is that if you want to reach the swing voters in these areas, and I think even in the exurbs to some extent, it means you've got to go and mobilize your base. It means you've got to go beyond this mantra of prescription drugs for seniors and defending Social Security and saying very little else. I mean, these are, we now know for sure that these things are not enough to fire up anybody and to reach swing voters. You need a much broader and bigger agenda to some extent. I mean, where are the Democrats on education? This is an issue people care about deeply in the suburbs, including the outer suburbs, and where blacks and Hispanics have a huge, you know, very high levels of concern as well. The Democrats' program in education was to say we'd be better on it, right? I mean, you know, they all voted for the No Child Left Behind Act, and then they pointed out rightly that the resources weren't really there to make it work. If you're going to hold schools to high standards, you know, we have to provide them with the resources, the teachers, the class size, and the buildings that would make this stuff work. But they never really put out anything that really made that point forcefully. And I think that's a point that a lot of people, you know, would be interested in that would make Democrats enthusiastic. If the Democrats want to challenge the president and national security, they can't just, like, vote for the Iraq resolution and then sort of mutter under their breath, you know, he's not going about it right. They've got to provide an alternative. They've got to appear in some ways to be tougher than the president, but on different things. You know, maybe Iraq isn't the way, maybe invading Iraq isn't the way that's really going to make us feel secure or actually produce security. Maybe there are other ways. Well, you know, we haven't heard about them from the Democrats, but, you know, you can probably think of a few, and I think I can too. But the Democrats need to put that forward because it's a huge issue. You can't just punt. You can't just say, you know, I support the president too.
All right. We'll have to bring it to a close there. Thanks for joining us.
Sure.
Rita Teixeira. Rita Teixeira is the author, along with John Judas, of the recently published book, The Emerging Democratic Majority, and a fellow at the Century Foundation based in Washington, D.C. And we'll be back in a moment after this word from 10cc. CC from their rather ancient song, Wall Street Shuffle. We've been on broadcasting from Wall Street for years now, but I think that's the first time it occurred to me to play that as break music, and you gotta be cruel to make your mark. Speaking of cruelty, the Bloomberg administration is releasing its budgetary plans, and there was an important press conference and some releases this afternoon. And the city is in dire budgetary shape, and I've been talking about this for some time and plan to continue to talk about it. But the immediate crisis at hand is a gap of well over $1 billion this year and possibly as much as $6.5 billion next year, which is a lot of money. And I called up Bonnie Brower, who is the director of the City Project, a budget watchdog group, to talk about it earlier today. This was before some of the details were released at a 2 o'clock press conference. I recorded at about 1:30. So, but I have a copy of the financial plan that I nabbed off the web, and I'll read it as we're listening to Bonnie Brower and give you a little instant analysis after it's over if we have some time left. So let's listen to Bonnie Brower.
Welcome to WBAI, Bonnie Brower. The city budget looks bad. How bad is it?
Well, it's horrendous. We are facing a $1.1 billion deficit in the current fiscal year, and apparently a $6.4 billion deficit for fiscal 04, which starts July 1 in 2003. And the question that people need to be asking themselves and pressing their elected officials is, what balance of tax increases and service cuts make the most sense to keep this city viable, vital, and vibrant, and to meet all the many needs of the people who live here?
But to put that deficit in perspective, $6.5 billion on how big a budget?
On a $42.3 billion budget. It's an enormous deficit.
Fiscal monitors and such have been predicting, they've been talking about a structural deficit in the city's finances for a very, very long time. How much of this is structural? How much of this is recession? How much of this is 9/11? What's causing this big hole?
Well, our estimate is that at least half of it is structural. At least half of it is a result of regular recurring revenues not equaling regular recurring expenditures. And probably a little less than half might be attributable to the combination of September 11th and the recession. But we need to recognize that even in the recently expired hot go-go economic years, our revenues were out of whack with our expenses on an ongoing basis.
People around the Manhattan Institute and such would say that the problem is the city just spends too generously, that we try to run a welfare state of almost Scandinavian generosity here. Why is spending so out of whack? I presume that you're not going to concur with the Manhattan Institute analysis.
No, strangely enough, I don't concur with the Manhattan Institute. I would say our revenues are out of whack, not our expenditures. We have seen since the mid-90s over $14 billion in state tax cuts. We've seen almost $3 billion in city tax cuts. Those tax cuts have overwhelmingly benefited the very wealthiest people and biggest businesses in both the city and state. And while we were generating more personal income tax revenues than is usual during those years because of the sizzling Wall Street market, those were clearly not going to continue. Those really were surpluses in every sense of the word. They were, you know, an unexpected windfall. And we used those windfalls to disguise the fact that that our revenues and our expenses on an ongoing basis were still profoundly and structurally out of whack with each other, which is in fact what the State Financial Control Board found. They said we have a structural imbalance, and we agree. But I don't think the issue is that we expend too much on services. Clearly we have some waste, we have some fat. All of those things can and should be looked at and corrected. But New York City is the great city it is because of the extraordinarily diverse, high-level, and sophisticated public programs and services that we provide.
We just had a governor's race last year. We had a mayor's race.
Yeah.
None of these issues were really discussed in any kind of detail. Is this just out of politics completely to talk about? Is it too important to talk about in an election?
Well, one would hope not, but I have to admit that I was astounded, not by the candidate's failure to address the issue of the fact that the state's budget is more out of whack than the city's, but at the media's failure to pursue the issue. Everyone who has looked at all at the state budget and its fiscal situation knew that the day after the election, the state's budget would tank, which indeed it has. So, while it was completely irresponsible for the candidates not to address what they would do other than Stanley Aronowitz of the Green Party, I am more surprised that the media did not force the issue into the open.
The last time the city was having fiscal troubles, big fiscal troubles in the mid-1970s, the state was able to come to the city's rescue because it was in relatively better financial shape. Is that just not a possibility this time around?
It's not only not a possibility, it's an impossibility. The state may be looking at a budget gap of as much as $10 billion. And I think you got to go further than that. For the past 10 years, the state of New York has really been, well, the only word I can think of is screwing New York City. And it's been doing it in a major ongoing way. Not only did the state legislature with the governor's imprimatur repeal the commuter tax in 99, but since 9/11, virtually the only state assistance that New York provided the city after the attacks on the World Trade Center was enabling us to increase our own debt service. They gave us no aid whatsoever. They took away $114 million we've been getting every year since the 70s in lieu of the stock transfer tax. They also stole half the city's increased cigarette tax revenues. That was their payment for the state legislature signing off on this whopping sin tax on cigarettes that the city sought to get to try and close its budget gap. They continue to shortchange us with respect to transportation aid, housing aid, education aid, environmental cleanup aid. So we really are seeing in very bold and bold ways the fact that the city is really a colony of the state in the traditional sense of the word. We generate the state's wealth and income, and we get very little of it back proportionally.
And would you attribute the state's fiscal problems mainly to a similar round of tax cutting over the last decade?
George Pataki is bragging about the fact that since the mid-90s, he's accomplished over $14 billion in tax cuts. If you do the arithmetic and you see that they're facing up to a $10 billion budget gap, I would say there's a direct relationship there, yeah.
Now, the theory, at least the polite theory, of why these tax cuts were undertaken was that they're supposed to to stimulate economic development. But you know,
they don't seem to have done that.
I was going to say, the upstate is mostly depressed.
Right.
The city isn't in bad shape. How serious is the underlying economic tone of the city and state?
The city situation, I think, is more complicated. One of the problems that I think our current crisis reveals is that we have become way, way too reliant on the on the boom and bust cycle of Wall Street revenues. We are addicted to those revenues without acknowledging that by their nature they're cyclical, and we're on a downslide now, which is costing us hundreds of millions of dollars of personal income tax revenue. So one thing that I think the crisis should instruct New York is to change its economic development policy to foster a far more diversified economy, which we are capable of doing. We just have never seemed to have had the will to do so. The other thing is we need to acknowledge that in New York City, the backbone of our economy is not the handful of huge businesses, but rather the 89% of businesses that have under 20 employees. The total with under 100 employees is 98%. And we don't seem to do anything to stimulate their growth or solidify, you know, their base. So I think, number one, we should be looking to change our entire approach to economic development and the economy. That's not a small thing to say, but we could start with some of the tax exemption and abatement programs that we have, where we forego hundreds of millions of dollars in revenue in order to bribe big companies to stay in New York or allegedly to create new jobs, which they don't do. So that's one thing. Those are two things I think we should do. The other thing I think we have to do, and we have to do it immediately, is really assess New York City's own proliferating and complicated tax structure. Let me be very specific. We have three business taxes that the city imposes on different kinds and different forms of businesses. the largest number of businesses subject to one of those taxes, the tax is the general corporation tax. There are over 240,000 businesses subject to that tax. Over 125,000 of those businesses, 55%, pay only the minimum annual tax. That minimum tax is $300 a year. It was set in 1966 and was never changed. That's crazy. Families earning, working poor families with net incomes of $11,000 are paying more in personal income tax than these corporations are paying in corporate income tax. The same is true for the banking tax. They have even a lower minimum fee, $125 a year, which also was set in the 1960s and never changed. Equally important, the entire insurance industry in New York City is exempt from any corporate income taxes since 1974. According to one of the fiscal monitors in the city, that cost New York City last year $191 million in revenue. That's insane. It also gives them a preferred status over other businesses that are doing similar work beyond insurance, like in financial services and real estate. So we really need to take a very close look at all of our taxes. We need to re-examine them. We need to restructure them. We need to restructure the property tax. Small homeowners, owners of 1 to 3 family homes, are being subsidized by virtually every person in the city, not only owners of other kinds of property, but residential tenants as well. Small homes constitute 44% of the value of real property in New York City. They pay only 13% of the real property taxes. That's just basically unfair. The answer is not to raise everybody's property tax by as much as 25%. That's insane. But we need to restructure our taxes so that the burdens are more fair and equitably distributed among different classes of people. Lastly, with respect to the personal income tax, the mayor is apparently proposing to reduce the personal income tax rate by 25%. The greatest beneficiaries of that reduction will be the very wealthiest people in this city. People who benefited from, you know, years of tax cuts and who also benefited the most from the stock market sizzling period. There's not only no reason to reduce their personal income tax rate, there's every reason to consider putting a higher rate on the very wealthiest people in this city. They can afford to pay a greater part of the burden. And if they don't, we will be seeing we will see program and service cuts that go into the marrow and the heart of this city. So, you know, we really need to step back, look at all our revenue potential and possibilities, rationalize them, make them far more fair than they are now, and then look at what service cuts have to be made after we have substantially increased our revenue base.
I'm speaking with Bonnie Brower, who is the executive director of the City Project. You've alluded to some of the mayor's plans already. So, what? First of all, how forthcoming are they in revealing their fiscal scheming? But what do you know so far about what they're planning to do?
Well, first of all, just so that everybody knows, the full plan will be released at 2 o'clock this afternoon, just minutes from now, in a press conference that the mayor's having. They have dripped and leaked bits and pieces of it over the last few days. But, you know, as everybody always says, the devil's in the details, and the details have not really been released. I know from the drips and drabs we have learned, as well as from some of the mayor's more general, albeit slightly cryptic statements, that the only services that will not be heavily cut are the four horsemen, you know, police, fire, sanitation, and education. And each of those is going to take a hit. It's all the other services, many of which are funded solely by city revenues and don't have any legal or court mandates requiring them to be funded, that we're going to look for really, really deep cuts. And I think those would include services to the aging, youth services outside of, you know, the Department of Education, housing, which has been decimated over the last 10 years anyway, you name it. But and we're looking, I think, at probably up as much as 10% in cuts in those agencies. And we're also looking at a personnel freeze. 5,000 people have left the city in the last few months. Those jobs will largely be left open. The mayor's looking for $600 million in givebacks from labor. I haven't heard any givebacks being asked for from business, but, you know, I guess maybe I'm deaf. I don't know. But it's looking, and these are all things to initially address the current $1 billion-plus gap. When you look towards fiscal 04, you get really scared, because we're looking at, according to them this morning, $6.4 billion gap as of now. So we can't cut our way out of a gap that big. We have to raise revenues. We can't look to the state for very much help. We likely won't get very much help, if any, from the feds. So we are reliant on ourselves.
But, of course, we have to depend upon the state legislature to authorize a lot of these tax
changes. Unfortunately, yes. We have to go to the state legislature to raise every single tax, fee, and fine that the city has, except the property tax rate. And, you know, that's another sense in which I think New York City is a colony of the state. I mean, we don't have the power to control our own lives in very, very real and fundamental ways. You know, maybe it's time for another Boston Tea Party, only it'll be in New York Harbor. I don't know. At the very least, we should be seeking increased home rule, but I don't see anybody leading the charge to do that.
The mayor has proposed cutting the income tax and raising the property tax.
Right.
Could you give some details on that, and what's the thinking behind it?
I wish I could tell you the thinking behind it. It's very interesting, because the cut in the personal income tax for city residents is proposed to be made up by taxing the income of commuters that is earned in the city at the same reduced rate as city residents, which is a rate about 5 or 6 times higher than the old commuter tax rate. In other words, commuters used to pay less than a half of 1% in for the commuter tax. They're now going to be asked to pay 2.7%, which is the new rate, the new top rate for the personal income tax for city residents. The problem is that we are losing, we estimate, about $900 million from city residents' income tax, and hopefully making up a comparable amount by adding commuters at that rate, except whether the state legislature will even entertain that proposal is really open to question. And then the burden for city residents is going to be shifted to property owners. They're proposing a 25% increase to the property tax rate, which frankly is nuts. You know, people's incomes are not necessarily reflected in the value of their property, particularly people who have owned their property for a long time, whether it's small homes or condos or co-ops or commercial buildings you may have bought a long time ago. You may not be wealthy. You may be living on fixed income or, you know, moderate or middle class income. Your property now may be worth, you know, scads of money, but unless you plan to sell it, that is not liquid money to you. And if property taxes are increased by 25%, you could conceivably be forced out of your own homes, and you have to sell. The other class of people who will be definitely hurt, who have the least income to be able to bear that burden, is tenants. tenants in unregulated buildings will have property tax increases passed directly through to them, and even people in rent-stabilized and rent-controlled buildings will experience the increase because it will become part of the Rent Guideline Board's calculations for the annual increases. And those are people who get none of the benefits of tax deductions from property tax increases. So it's really shifting the burden from wealthier people who pay more personal income tax, because that's the way the income tax is structured, even though it's not tremendously progressive, they do pay a little more, to property owners who may or may not have more money to pay for this hugely increased property tax bill. You know, we believe the property tax rate should be increased, but it should be increased moderately. We believe the personal income tax rate should be increased at the upper ends, not reduced. And we also believe businesses need to pay their fair share. So I think I don't understand the rationale. It's the exact reverse of what the city council recommended last year. The city council recommended an increase in the personal income tax and no increase in the property tax. Now we have the mayor, who refused to consider either 6 months ago, saying, no, let's reduce the personal income tax, but give a whopping property tax increase. You know, other than political cynicism, I can't explain the rationale for it. It doesn't make sense to me fiscally. It doesn't make sense to me economically. It just doesn't make sense.
I guess we'll learn more in the coming days. But thanks for joining us, and I'm sure we'll be back in touch many times over the coming months.
Thanks. Sure, Doug. Thanks a lot.
And that was Bonnie Brower, who is the executive director of the City Project, recorded that interview earlier today. And you can find the mayor's budget plans on the Office of Management and Budget's website. It's right there. You can go to nyc.gov and follow the links from there if you're interested. I've just been reading through it while the Brower interview is playing, and the mayor's cover letter sort of reveals where he's coming from in a lot of ways. He says, unlike the mid-1970s, the economic foundation of New York remains strong. Population is at an all-time high. And then he says, major media corporations, including AOL, Time Warner, Hearst, The New York Times, and Bloomberg LP, strange coincidence of names there, are constructing new Manhattan headquarters. Hotel occupancy rates have recovered to pre-September 11th levels. So it seems that the mayor's point of view is really all about elite media companies, Wall Street, and business visitors and tourists. But for the ordinary folks who live here and work here, they don't really seem to enter his vision of the health or lack thereof of the New York economy. Looking through some of the schemes he's got for closing the budget gap for next year, which is estimated as high as $6.4 billion, which is a very large portion of a budget of $40, $45 billion. So we're talking about, 15% budget gap that has to be whacked out. And a lot of the a lot of the spending is off limits. About two-thirds of the budget is mandated and can't be reduced. So we're going to have to focus on fairly narrow areas and or raise taxes. But in the mayor's plans include about $1.1 billion in city expense reductions, cuts of various sorts, $2.3 billion in property tax increases, and then which comes to about half of the proposed gap closing. But the other half is a little wobbly. He's expecting $1.4 billion in state initiatives, $200 million in federal initiatives, and $600 million in increased workforce productivity, which I think means longer hours and lower pension contributions and things like that. But a lot of those the productivity assumptions are kind of wobbly and may not materialize, but even wobblier and less likely to materialize are the state initiatives. He's talking about, for example, New York City is, I think, the only locality in the United States, it's certainly the only locality in the state of New York, that actually pays its own Medicaid costs or a share of its Medicaid costs. The mayor hopes that the state will pick up that tab. That doesn't seem very likely. Also expecting additional of federal aid of various sorts, which I don't think is likely to materialize. So we're not I think he's kind of dreaming, and we're only beginning to see the kinds of cuts that will be necessary to balance the budget. You started talking about reductions to central administration for the Board of Education, cuts to CUNY scholarship programs, reduced services in small businesses, cuts in daycare slots, closing senior centers, eliminating youth services, closing fire companies, increase the private bus fare, cut funding to arts institutions, reevaluate collection frequency of garbage, which sounds like more garbage piling up on the sidewalks, and stuff like that, and it's only begun. So it doesn't sound very pretty. But we'll return to this and also return to the ideas of what the city can do to change its economic development strategy and change its economic base so it's less dependent on Wall Street and friendlier to the masses of people who live here. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Stay tuned for the news and on into the evening. Till next week, let's go out with this a little bit more from 10cc.